We reach a decisive point in Solomon's life. This is a decisive point in Solomon's life. A decisive moment. Chapter 9 comes at about the 24th year of Solomon's reign. Anybody know how long Solomon reigned altogether in Israel? 40 years. Solomon reigned for 40 years in Israel. He started on the temple at about his fourth year, and it took him 20 years to finish building the temple and to finish building his palace complex. And we've been studying about that over the last couple of weeks. Chapter 8, last week, Solomon's spiritual life, Solomon's love for God reaches a crescendo. And it was a crescendo of praise and a crescendo of prayer. And it was just a fantastic. I couldn't wait to teach chapter 8 because there's so much there. So much love that Solomon has. So much commitment Solomon has. It is a high point of his spiritual life. But chapter 9 brings us to a decisive moment. Just over half his kingship is finished. Just over half of his reign is finished. How would it end up? How would Solomon come out, so to speak, at the end of that time? Well, you see, chapter 9 gives us a little bit of insight into that. In fact, chapter 9 and chapter 10 are really going to show us what happens in Solomon's life, and it ain't pretty, as the saying goes. The crescendo of his life, the ultimate, the penultimate of his life was chapter 8 in his worship and praise and prayer with God. And in chapter 9, God appears to him to remind him that he needed to be steadfast, to remind him that he needed to be wholehearted in his devotion to God. Solomon, I truly believe, was at a spiritual crossroads in his life. He was at a spiritual crossroads in his life. Now, Solomon's not going to make some great step of turning away from the Lord where he says, I've had enough, I'm not going to believe any longer the God of Israel, I'm just going to turn my back on God and the worship of God and I'm going to walk away. That's not what happens in his life. Something even more insidious happens in Solomon's life, and that is that he, as one writer put it, gradually drifts away from the Lord. He gradually drifts away from the Lord. We see that in chapter 9. We'll see more of it in chapter 10. Until we read in chapter 11, and I'd like you to look there because we'll take a couple of weeks, but we'll get there to chapter 11. Till we read in chapter 11 and verse 4, toward the end of Solomon's kingship, as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. And then it goes on to tell us that he followed Ashtoreth and he worshipped Moloch. Think about this. Think about this. How did that happen in Solomon's life? How did we get from chapter 3 when Solomon is asked by God, what do you want? I'll give you anything you want. A bird just found out we have windows here. Not, but he flew off. I saw him fly off, so he's okay. No need for CPR or anything like that. Okay. Of course, I don't know how you do bird CPR, but I suppose there's a way. Okay. Where were we again? Okay. Chapters 9 and chapter 10 help us to answer the question, how did Solomon get from chapter 3, where he's so wholehearted in his devotion to God, from chapter 3, where he asked God for nothing but wisdom, and God says, I'm going to give you wisdom, and because that's what you asked for, I'm going to give you so much more. How do we get from there to chapter 8, where Solomon just leads the people in such worship of God? Then how do we all of a sudden get to chapter 11, where he's worshiping false gods? Now understand, he didn't turn his back on God, he's still worshiping God. He just tacked on Ashtoreth. He just tacked on Moloch and other gods of the wives he married. What happened to Solomon? Well, you see, little by little and step by step, he walked away from God. Not one giant step. It wasn't, I'm turning my back, but little by little. And I tell you what, folks, the reason this is important to you, the reason this is important to me, is because that's how it happens to us also. It's those little decisions. It's those little attitudes that begin to crop up in our lives. And we begin, instead of worshiping God wholeheartedly, we begin to worship God with an asterisk. You know, like all the baseball statistics that will one day have an asterisk done with drugs. That's a whole nother story. We don't want an asterisk beside our lives, do we? I don't want one beside my spiritual life. You don't want one beside your spiritual life. That little by little, we took little steps away from God. Oh, we didn't make a giant step. We didn't turn our back on God. We didn't say, I don't want you anymore. I don't worship you anymore. We just said, you're not enough. You're not enough. I need more. I want more. What were those little steps in Solomon's life? Well, in Solomon's life, we're going to see here in chapter 9, and we're going to see it again in chapter 10. In Solomon's life, there was a love of luxury creeping in. You see it, how he began to love luxurious things. And he began to crave luxurious things. There was a love of wealth coming into his life. And we're going to see by the end of this chapter that he is doing all he can to find, to bankrupt the world of its gold supply. Love of luxury, love of wealth. There's a love of recognition. We'll see that even greater next week in chapter 10 as the Queen of Sheba comes and visits him. But there's a love of recognition and being known as the greatest king of the day. And don't get me wrong, Israel was in its heyday. This was the heyday of Israel. For all intents and purposes, if you're looking from the outside at Israel, you're saying, wow, what a nation. They must really love their God. Well, they're really committed. Oh, Solomon, what a king. He really loves God. The trouble is, the rot was going on in the inside. You didn't see it from the outside. You didn't see it from the outside of the nation. You didn't see it from the outside of Solomon, but it was going on. These little steps away, love of luxury, love of wealth, love of recognition, love of expansion. Love of expansion, love of prosperity, and love of might. Little by little, all of these things crept into Solomon's life and took him step by step by step by step away from God. Little by little, rather than wholehearted devotion to God and wholehearted love for God, he is taking step by step by step away from God as he begins to love other things, luxury and wealth and recognition and expansion and prosperity and might. How do you get from chapter 3 to chapter 11 in your life? You do it by taking little steps. Little steps. All right, we're going to see more of these steps in Solomon's life. But what chapter 9 is, it's a time when I believe that Solomon is at a crossroads. I believe that God, realizing Solomon's at a crossroads, for the second time in Solomon's life, God appears to him. It happened earlier at Gibeon in chapter 3. It happens again now. Now, God spoke to him three times, but the second time in between Gibeon and now, he didn't come and appear to him. This is the third time he's speaking to Solomon, the second time he's appearing to him. It happened a little past the halfway mark of his reign, and I believe he's at a crossroads, and I believe that God wants to draw him back. I believe God sees in his life this tendency to want to move away, this gradual moving away from God. And so God comes to him in chapter 9 and urges him to be faithful and urges him, reminds him to guard his heart, reminds him to be wholehearted in his devotion. And we'll see that in just a moment. What I want you to see as we go through this, for your life and for my life, is it's the little attitudes that we allow in our lives. It's the little decisions we make in our lives. It's the little dissatisfactions in our lives that take us away from God. And one step leads to a second step, leads to a third step, leads to a fourth step, until we find ourselves, like Solomon, in chapter 11, worshiping the wrong gods. And instead of being the great name that and great name for God that he could have been, he becomes somewhat of a byword. He introduced idolatry into Israel, and himself became an idolater. Well, look with me at chapter 9 and verse 1. When Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord and the royal palace and had achieved all he had desired to do, the Lord appeared to him a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. Right? This is a dangerous time in his life. He has spent 20 years pouring all of his energy, and actually 24 if you include the four before the actual work began in the temple. He had spent 24 years pouring all of his life, all of his energy, all of his thought into these buildings. And suddenly he's accomplished his life work. That is a really dangerous time for every one of us when we get to a place where we believe we've accomplished a lot. That's a time when we're going to need more than ever to renew our commitment to God. That's a time when we're going to need more than ever to watch that we aren't making those little steps away from God. That's where Solomon is in his life. Verse 3, the Lord speaks to him and says, I have heard the prayer and plea you have made before me. I have consecrated this temple which you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there. You see, before chapter 8, when we studied last week, before the cloud came and God set up His residence in the temple, that was nothing but a beautiful, ornate, expensive building. It's God whose presence in that temple consecrated it, or set it apart, or made it holy. That's the idea of consecration, to make it holy. That is, it was an ordinary building, no matter how spectacular, it was an ordinary building until God said, my name will rest in this house. There's a great analogy to our lives. You see, the moment you and I come to faith in Jesus Christ, what happens? The Holy Spirit comes to live within us. You know what? Until that happens, we're an ordinary building. But the moment we come to faith, the moment God moves into our lives, we become holy. We become consecrated. We become something special for God, to God, for God. That's what happened. God said, I have consecrated the building. It was the temple. It was just a building before Solomon. Don't get too proud. You built it. You did a good job. But don't get too proud. It was nothing but a building till I entered it. We can't get too proud of ourselves because we were nothing but a building till God entered us. That's why Paul says, why do you glory? What you've received, you've received from God. Why do you glory as if you produced it yourself? Well, this is interesting. In verse 3, he says, my name, my eyes, my heart will always be there. My name, my eyes, my heart. What does that mean? What's God saying? Well, it's a reference to the fact that God is saying that He would care for His people Israel. He would care for His people Israel. He put His name there. That means that He identified with the people. He identified with the nation. He put His name there. His eyes meant that He was always watching them, always looking over them, always caring for them, and would take care of their needs. His heart was there. He loved them with an unchanging love, with an unstoppable love, with a steadfast love. One writer said this, the phrases, my name, my eyes, my heart, indicate God's nearness to His people. He is identified with us. He watches over us. He loves us. Isn't that great? Isn't that great? When He said to Solomon, my name, my eyes, my heart are with that place, He was saying, I'm going to take care of you, Solomon. I'm going to take care of your needs. I'm going to watch over you. I'm going to answer your needs. I'm going to answer your prayers. And that's what happens for us as well. God's name is over us. He identifies with us. His name, His eye is upon us to watch over us and care for us. His heart is over us to show how much He loves us. Now, there's an interesting passage I don't think a lot of people are familiar with. I'd like you to turn to it. It's in 2 Chronicles. You're in 1 Kings. Turn to 2 Kings, then 1 Chronicles, then 2 Chronicles. Kind of funny how that works, isn't it? Okay, 2 Chronicles, rather, chapter 16 and verse 9. And if you don't have this underlined, I just urge you to underline it. 2 Chronicles, chapter 16 and verse 9. For the eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to Him. You know what that's saying? That's saying that God is looking all across the earth. God's eyes are ranging all across the earth to look for those who are fully committed to Him so that He can strengthen them. That's you. That's me. He's constantly looking across the earth. He's constantly looking for those whose hearts are committed to Him so that He can strengthen them. Do you need strength today? God's eyes are going to and fro in the face of the earth looking for people He can strengthen whose hearts are devoted to Him. Now, a lot of us don't know 2 Chronicles 16:9, but a lot of us do know 1 Peter 5, and I think it's verse 8, where it says that Satan is doing what? Going to and fro on the face of the earth, looking for whom he may devour, destroy. As a believer in Jesus Christ, I want you to be encouraged today, and I want you to remember, Satan's going to and fro on the face of the earth looking for people to destroy. God's eyes are going to and fro on the face of the earth looking for those who are devoted to Him whom He may strengthen. Never think of 1 Peter 5 without thinking of 2 Chronicles 16. Never allow yourself to become fearful about Satan and his going to and fro on the face of the earth, because your God, my God, is going to, his eyes are going to and fro on the face of the earth looking for who he may take care of. You and me, those who know him as Savior. It's a great thing. Well, back in 1 Kings chapter 9, God begins to warn Solomon, to remind him that Israel was not just another nation. Solomon was not just another king. Yahweh was not just another God. God wasn't interested. Oh, good, I'm so happy. The temple's up and running. Sacrifices are being offered day after day. Whoa, whoopee! That's not what God was looking for. He's not looking for somebody to go through rituals. Today, all across this world, people are going to churches or whatever faith they are in, going through rituals because it is a holy day, in quotes. Be they called Christian or something else, multitudes across the world going today to complete a ritual. God's not interested in ritual completers. God's interested in those whose hearts are His. Those whose hearts are His. And He's letting Solomon know that. He's reminding Solomon that he's to be steadfast, not just to go through ritual. Yeah, you got a nice building now, Solomon, and I have consecrated it. I have made it my own. But don't think now that you can just go through the ritual. And in verse 4 he says, "As for you, if you walk before me in integrity of heart and in uprightness, and uprightness as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, 'You shall never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel.'" Solomon, I don't want you going through the motions. It's gut check time. Maybe today is gut check time for us. How is our devotion? Are we taking those little steps away? Is the love of other things crowding in so that it's not that we don't love God anymore, it's just that we don't love Him as much anymore? Now I want you to observe something in verse 4. Who is God's example to Solomon? Just look at verse 4, take a minute to read it, and then tell me, who does God hold up as an example to Solomon? David. David is the example that God holds up to Solomon and said, "You want to see somebody who is wholeheartedly in devotion to me? All you have to do is look at your father David." Now, I'd be willing to bet, and I'm not a betting man, but I think I'd win this one, okay? That a lot of Christians before who maybe don't know as much about 1 Kings and the history of Israel, if you were to just go up there and say, "I want a quick answer, who's the greatest sinner, David or Solomon?" I bet most Christians and most people would say, "Well, obviously it's got to be David." Because the great sin of David's life is what? Adultery with Bathsheba. And then following the adultery with Bathsheba, he had her husband killed. And I'm sure there are a lot of people who would say, well, of course David's the greatest sinner. But it's not true. Solomon's the greater sinner. Solomon is the one who had a divided heart. Solomon's the one who began to love other things and his love for God waned. Solomon is the one that the epitaph of his life is he brought idolatry to Israel and he himself worshipped idols. That could never be said of his father David. Did David fail? You bet he did. Did David blow it big time? Did David sin in a mighty way? He did. He did. Is adultery a big time sin? Well, yes and no. All sin's a big time sin. To God, the whitest white lie would have sent Jesus to the cross. You put a value on sin. All sin is sin in God's sight. But as great as the sin of adultery is in David's life, God looks to him and says to his son Solomon, look at your father David and be like him. His heart was fully devoted to me. Excuse me, God, just a minute here. Don't you remember the adultery? God says, no, I don't. No, I don't. But I do know when people don't love me anymore or love me the way they used to. Was that sin great in David's life? It was. Did it take a great toll in his life? It did. Did he confess it to God and was he cleansed? He did, and he was. If you wonder about that, I want you on your own sometime to read Psalm 32 and Psalm 51. There are two of David's Psalms that express what came into his life because of the sin with Bathsheba and how he confessed his sin to God. When he said to God, against you and you only have I sinned. See, God's looking for a broken and contrite heart. And so he can hold up. Did David sin a great sin? Yes, he did. He committed adultery. But Solomon committed a greater sin. He committed spiritual adultery. It's worse. It's worse. And David is Solomon's, God's example for Solomon. God says, I'll establish David's throne. One writer said this, as long as Israel had a king, he was in the line of David, and there is one today in David's line whose nail-pierced hands hold the scepter of this universe. Now, David's dynasty was interrupted because Israel was carried off into captivity. But God promised they would come back to the land, and in fact, they're in the land today. And there is coming a time when the Messiah will return, and he is of the line of David, and will take the throne of David in the millennium. As one writer said, David's dynasty was interrupted by the Babylonian captivity, but will be restored when Messiah takes David's throne in the millennium. Well, God's warning comes starting in verse 6. But if you or your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them and will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. Israel will then become a byword and an object of ridicule among all peoples. And though this temple is now imposing, all who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple? People will answer, because they have forsaken the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of Egypt and who embraced other gods, worshiping and serving them. That is why the Lord brought all this disaster on them. If they weren't wholehearted in their devotion, God said, you're going to be removed from the land and the temple will be destroyed and you'll be a byword and the temple will be a byword. The people would be exiled, the temple would be rejected by God, the world would ridicule Israel. And even the Gentiles would question, why would Israel, whose God brought them out of bondage in Egypt, took them through the wilderness, brought them into this great land, made them such a great nation, how could they turn their backs on the God who did that for them? Even Gentiles, even pagans will say that God said about Israel. You see, even pagans in their false worship are faithful to their false god. How could Israel, whose God did so much for them, how could they not be faithful to Him? That's what the nations would say. Now, why would God allow this? Why would God bring this into His people's lives? Well, He does this because He is doing something better for them. He is trying to bring Israel back to Himself. They go away, He brings them back. They go away, He brings them back, until ultimately He lets them go into exile with still the promise that He would bring them back. He allows the hard things in their lives and in our lives to refocus our thoughts and our lives for Him. In Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis said an interesting thing. I want you to think about your Christian life in thinking about this, in listening to this. And he pretty well nails all of us. He says this: when a man turns to Christ and seems to be getting on pretty well, in the sense that some of his bad habits are now corrected, he often feels that it would now be natural if things went fairly smoothly. You ever feel like that? Boy, you know, I'm a Christian, I got some act clean up. Be real nice for things to go smoothly now. When troubles come along, illnesses, money troubles, new kinds of temptations, he's disappointed. These things he feels might have been necessary to rouse him and make him repent in his bad old days, but why now? This is the answer. Because God is forcing him on or up to a higher level, putting him into situations where he will have to be very much braver or more patient or more loving than he ever dreamed of being before. It seems to us all unnecessary, but that is because we have not yet had the slightest notion of the tremendous thing God means to make of us. God is making us something spectacular. And to do that, you know, we get content. We think, well, I've cleaned up my act. I'm doing a little better. You know, I'm trying to do the right thing. And then, bam, some hardship comes into our life. Some difficult thing comes into our life. And we say, why? What's God doing? He's trying to make us into a tremendous thing. At another part of Christianity, C.S. Lewis borrows an analogy from George MacDonald, the analogy of a house. Let me quickly share this with you. Imagine yourself as a living house. God comes in to rebuild that house. At first, perhaps you can understand what He is doing. He's getting the drains right, stopping the leaks in the roof, and so on. You knew that those jobs needed doing, and so you're not surprised. But presently, He starts knocking the house about in a way that hurts abominably and does not seem to make sense. What on earth is He up to? The explanation is that he is building quite a different house from the one you thought of. Throwing out a new wing here, putting on an extra floor there, running up towers, making courtyards. You thought you were going to be made into a decent little cottage, but He's building a palace. I love that. We're content to be a decent little cottage. God is making me into a decent little cottage. No, He's not. God is making you into a palace. God is making me into a palace. And sometimes it takes some pretty rough construction to take this and make it a palace. It took some rough construction in Israel's life. Well, in chapter 9, verses 1 to 9, God warns Solomon, encourages him to be steadfast because Solomon's at a crossroads. Tells him that there's a lot on the line. And now for the rest of the chapter, what we're basically going to see is these steps. The rest of chapter 9 and all of chapter 10, we're going to see these steps. These little bitty steps that Solomon takes and is moving away and away and turning his heart to other things. Dividing his love between God and things. God and wealth. God and expansion. God and recognition. All of these things. In verses 10 to 14, we see Hiram again, the king of Tyre, who provided the wood for the temple and the palaces. And we find out that at the end of 20 years, during which Solomon built these two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the royal palace, King Solomon gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram, king of Tyre. Now, why did he give those towns? Well, we believe verse 14 answers that. Now, Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. We believe that Solomon had maybe bankrupted the country or had committed so many resources to his building, to his expansion, to all of this, that he had to borrow gold from Hiram. And to secure the loan, he offered up 20 towns in Galilee. Well, Hiram went to see him. Verse 12, when Hiram went from Tyre to see the towns that Solomon had given him, he was not pleased with them. What kind of towns are these that you've given me, my brother? He asked, and he called them the land of Kabul. Kabul means good for nothing. Good for nothing. Now, by the way, it's hard to transfer things like, you know, the value of that gold to today, because you have to figure out what is a talent, then you've got to figure out the exchange rate, and you've got to try to put it in today's terms. The best I could come up with, and you know, take this with a grain of salt, is that this 120 talents of gold was worth about $5 million. It was a loan of $5 million. So it wasn't chump change, right? It wasn't reaching into the sofa to find 99 cents to go to McDonald's, right? There's quite a bit of money, and the 20 towns are given in exchange. Now, in verses 15 through 24, we read about all that Solomon did using forced labor to build up the fortifications and to protect Israel. You read about a lot of towns here that were turned into fortifications. Mentioned here in verses 15 to 19 were used either to defend Israel or to put a store of munitions and food. Verses 20 to 23 talks about the forced labor. The people who were left in the land, and they're named in verse 20, these people were made slave laborers. The Israelites were not used for slave labor, but they had a little easier jobs. And so it tells us about that. Verse 24, after Pharaoh's daughter had come up from the city of David to the palace Solomon had built for her, he constructed the supporting terraces. A lot of question. What are these supporting terraces? Let me just give you a little. This is just sort of a historical note, okay? Apparently at the temple area where the temple was built, and remember the complex of palaces that was attached to the temple, the land was uneven there, different elevations, valleys, that sort of thing. The supporting terraces seemed to be places where Solomon had the land filled in and leveled out because the complex was large. So that's probably what these milos or supporting terraces were. Now, verse 25, I find this interesting. In all of these verses, first we have in chapter 9 God's warning to Solomon, and then we have all these verses talking about his expansion, his fortifications, his need for money, giving away towns. We see all of this, and then one little verse, verse 25, three times a year, Solomon sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings on the altar he had built for the Lord, burning incense before the Lord along with them, and so fulfilled the temple obligations. One little verse. Now, some people say, well, see, at least Solomon's no longer worshiping at the high places as he did earlier in the book. He's now worshiping at the temple. He's worshiping the three great festivals of Israel, and he's worshiping there. And many say, you know, well, he's on the right path. You know, I look at that and I say a lot of verses are given to his expansion, a lot of verses are given to his wealth, and only one verse is given to God. Was Solomon at the point in his life where he was beginning to just go through the ritual? Had he divided his love enough and taken enough steps away from God to where he just did the minimum? I don't know, but it smacks of that to me in verse 25. Verse 26, 27 and 28 talks more about his expansion. Now Solomon has a navy. And Hiram, who was expert at shipbuilding and had expert sailors, taught Solomon and Solomon's sailors. No doubt built ships in conjunction with Solomon. Why are they doing this? Well, now they have access to all the ports of southeastern Africa, access to all the ports of southern Asia, and we read in these verses, and we'll read again in chapter 10, that Solomon was able to bring back mounds of gold from these places and able to bring back exotic goods from these places. More steps. More steps. More love of other things. Verse 28, they sail to Ophir. By the way, we don't even know for sure where Ophir was. They sailed to Ophir and brought back 420 talents of gold, which they delivered to King Solomon. That's, if the other rendering is correct, at $5 million, this would be about $17 million in gold. Again, we're going to have a lot to say next week about Solomon's collecting gold and horses and chariots. But do you get the picture? Do you see what's going on in Solomon's life? He is at a crossroads in chapter 9. He's at a crossroads in his life, and he's taking steps away from God. Little by little, other loves are crowding into his life. I want to close with this. The question for you and the question for me is, what do we love? What do we love? And is the love of other things crowding into our lives, and so that our love for God isn't what it once was, and it's divided, and now we love God, but we love this, and we love God, but we love this, and we love God, but we love this, but our love is no longer wholehearted. You ask me, well, how do I know? How do I know what I love? Let me suggest just three things. Look at your calendar, Palm Pilot, whatever it is you use. How do you spend your time? What does the bulk of your time go to? Is it things that are God-honoring, that are serving God, or is it the bulk of things for yourself? Expansion, luxury, recognition, those things. Second thing, how do we know what we love? Look at your checkbook. What do you spend money on? What do I spend money on? That gives us a pretty good indication of where we are spiritually, of what's important to us in life. Are the things of God, does our checkbook and bank statement reflect the things of God, or does it reflect ourselves, our needs? The last thing, what do you think about? When you're thinking about different things through the day, what do you think about? Do you think about what you don't have? Do you think about what you're dissatisfied about? Do you think about what you wish you had? All those things take us away from God. The question for us is, what is the great motivation of our lives? What do we really love? There may be somebody here this morning who's at a crossroads. They're at the same place Solomon was in chapter 9. And they're at a crossroads. May Solomon be a cautionary tale to us, to not dilute our love for God, to not divide our love for God, but to be wholeheartedly as David was. That doesn't mean we'll be perfect people. You fail and I fail. You sin and I sin. But it does mean that we humbly and contritely go to God and confess our sin to Him. And He restores us and He uses us and He can look back and say, look at them. What do you love?